We're going to bring y'all into our huddle.
You are in the huddle with me, Scott, and joining me from Chicago is Rusty Simmons, the San Francisco Chronicles beat writer for the 2015 NBA champs. What's going on, Rusty?
Oh, I'm doing well. I think we've shown our dedication here that I'm willing to do this from Chicago. I'm sure you're busy as can be, and Bram no-shows on us.
I think it goes to the obvious point here is Bram is not with us tonight. He was unfortunately not able to join us. We have shown our dedication. I'm wondering if this might be sort of a Luke Walton, Steve Kerr situation where I just come in, I kill it, and I've got people, other podcasts just recruiting me after this.
That's right, yeah. People in L.A. and Brooklyn will be calling any minute now.
I can only hope. I've really been wanting to start up a Lakers and or Brooklyn podcast. I want to jump right into the, to our first segment, the Insiders Report. You are with this team nonstop. You have incredible access that we don't have. Want to take advantage of that. Let's start with the obvious, Cleveland. I mean, that was just a demolition that we witnessed last night against the full-strength Cavs at the Cavs' home court. And I think it was that much sweeter given the awful loss against Detroit two nights before. What did you see happen with this team to account for the night and day difference from their play in Detroit versus Cleveland? Did they do anything different? Did they start watching more film? Did they actually take a break? I mean, did anything change, or is this just they happened to play great one night and they happened to not play great another?
No, I think there were huge changes, both emotionally and physically. And being around them this much, I should know by now that they have a great history of responding. When they play horrible in one game, they usually do bounce back and put it on somebody. But I didn't really expect that. After the Detroit game, I thought they looked bad. I thought they've looked bad for a month. They've been winning, but I didn't think they played very well. They're so talented that they put together 6 or 8 minutes of good basketball, and that's enough to beat most people. And so to me, Detroit was, they had lost 3 out of 11, and that's just kind of the way things were trending. But this team is stinking competitive, and all of a sudden they were interested again. They were sick of losing. They thought they got embarrassed in Detroit. Cleveland obviously gets their attention. They were going back to a place where they clinched the NBA Finals and had a bunch of good memories. So I think emotionally I should have predicted that they would bounce back that way. And then physically we saw some changes. There were some changes in the rotation. But I think most importantly was Cleveland continues to blitz Stephen Curry. I think the only other team that maybe does it this much is the Los Angeles Clippers. And normally when teams do that, Curry is unselfish and is happy to pass the ball to Draymond Green out of the double teams, and then Draymond Green plays 4-on-3. And they did that quite a bit. But Stephen Curry also then sprinted 2 spots on the three-point line in an attempt to get the ball back to give Draymond one more option or to hunt his own shots. And I thought that was a change. I don't think we've seen that a lot from Curry, that when he's forced to give the ball up out of the pick and roll, that he fights to get it back.
So has this... The poor play, because I totally agree with you. The Detroit game, while it was kind of the worst loss, it was not totally an exception to the poor play that's been going on. I mean, I think they were, since the streak ended, they've been 13-4. Compare that to the Spurs, who have been 16-1. I think even Cleveland's been 14-3. So is it just the lack of focus and intensity changed when they got back to the Cleveland? I mean, is that it more than anything else?
Yeah, I think energy, intensity, focus, all of that lacks, and that's human nature. When you're not being challenged, when you continually get away with playing 6 or 8 minutes, and that's good enough to win, the instant gratification is you won. Well, why do you need to focus? Why do you need to give more energy? And I think they fell into that rut a little bit. And the other thing is they're tired. This is a grueling part of the season. They turned what could have been 3 overnighters in L.A. and Portland and Sacramento into a week-long trip, came home for one, left for Denver, came home for one, and then went out on this 3-game road trip. So they're exhausted, but I think they're also mentally exhausted and weren't paying attention much, and this got their attention again.
Does this put an end to all the hypotheticals and what-ifs when it comes to Cleveland? We've heard so much about the lucky talk. We've heard so much about if we're at full strength or we were on the road then. Does this put an end to all of it?
I think so, yeah, and it's interesting. I was certain that all of that talk was silly. In fact, I said a lot on radio and TV during the finals when people would bring that up. I would say, you know what? I think this is actually better for Cleveland. If Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving were playing, the Warriors would run 1-4 pick and roll every play and not have to do anything else. Having Tristan Thompson in a 1-4 pick and roll is way better for Cleveland than having Kevin Love. And not a lot of people agreed with that, and it probably seemed a little harsh to some people, especially when I was doing Cleveland radio and TV. but that was my feeling. I've never seen Kevin Love defend well, and especially not in pick and rolls, and I think that was highlighted last night. And I think the Warriors always knew that. The only thing I'm surprised by is that Draymond Green or Andrew Bogut, guys who can't help themselves, haven't brought that up and said that on the record, because they were perturbed about all the lucky talk, and that would have been an easy argument for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, last night was just so satisfying. I imagine this was the first time that you've also returned to Cleveland since the finals?
Oh, no, I hang out there during the summers. That's one of my holiday spots.
Yeah, I know.
I go there only when I have to. It's funny. One of my best Bay Area friends is actually from Cleveland, so I did go on a vacation to Lake Huron one time, so I guess I can't make too much fun of it. It's an okay spot, but not the place I normally go. So, yeah, this was my first trip back there. And for sure, you do get some of those memories again. Things kind of sweep back into you, and you remember the 2 month slog of the playoffs and all the fun and stories that we got to tell during it.
Did you stay at the same hotel where you stayed during the finals?
I did not. Actually, during the finals, we stayed at a Residence Inn that is literally right across the street from Quicken Loans Arena. And this time, since it was snowing and insanely cold, I decided to stay at a hotel that was farther away. But the Chronicle will like it because it was cheaper.
Did your hotel room smell like champagne?
It did. It did. It smelled like champagne when I walked in, and then it smelled like Morton's Steakhouse when I left this morning. So,
Now I'm alluding there to the Steph quote that came out before the Cleveland game. He was asked about returning to Cleveland. He says, quote, "Obviously walking in the locker room, it'll be good memories. Hopefully it still smells a little bit like champagne." Now this quote blew up, and it kind of went viral to the point where Curry had to go onto Twitter and respond, hashtag read the whole quote. Members of the Cavs took this as being disrespectful. Was Curry taking jabs at the Cavs with this quote?
Not at all. Not at all. The rest of the quote is something to the effect of, we can't enjoy that very long because they're playing great right now and they've got all this momentum, and if we pay attention to the good vibes and our memories from last year, we're going to get exposed. But as often happens these days, people put the juicy part of the quote online, you know, as quick as clickbait, and don't give the rest of the quote. And then they show it to the other team and ask if they've been disrespected. And of course they're going to say yes, because they don't know the context of it. They don't know that the question was asked, how are you going to feel when you go back in there for the first time? And then they don't know how he finished his comment. And that's kind of one of the things that I guess people do in our business now. We ran the whole quote in the Chronicle, did not run it as clickbait, and got both sides to respond to what I thought was pretty insane buzz that happened because of it.
Did you ask the question that got Curry to give that quote?
You know what, at that they practiced pretty close to Auburn Hills before they took off to Cleveland, and we talked to Luke Walton, Stephen Curry, and Draymond Green that day, and all three of them were asked, and I don't remember. I probably asked it two of the three times, but I don't remember if it was Luke, Steph, or Draymond that were my two of the three. But it's a pretty obvious question. I mean, they're going back there for the first time, and you want to know what their emotions are going to be.
Do you get a little jealous when another reporter gets something that goes viral like that?
No, because I think it was so unethical the way it was. I mean, to put just that quote out there without the rest of it, to me, is, I don't care how many clicks you get or how happy your editor is. That's just unethical. That's not what he said. You know, he said that whole comment of how great Cleveland was playing all in one breath. So, yeah, I mean, to do clickbait, I think is really unethical and something that I hope the Chronicle never demands of me.
Well, I imagine somebody who did get the probably hit the champagne bottle was J.R. Smith when he got ejected during that game.
right.
Which was just, did you think that that warranted an ejection?
I understand why it happened. I didn't think that play in and of itself was a flagrant two, was an ejectable offense. But you could see the way the game was going. The game was getting physical, so I understand the officials trying to stop it right there. And also, you know J.R. Smith's history. And so I think something that might be a flagrant one for somebody else is probably a flagrant two for him. And he didn't put up much of an argument. He high-fived some fans on the way out and went ahead and headed to the locker room.
So is that true that when they do the replay in Secaucus, New Jersey, they are taking into account, like, J.R. Smith and his history?
They're not supposed to. That stuff is supposed to happen in the post-act fines, like when the NBA responds to the play the next day or within a week, gets all the details of it. Then they can take into account a player's past behavior and things like that. It's not supposed to happen in the game. But in this situation, I understand it because that, to me, was the way the game was going. I thought it was getting really physical. Clearly, the game was, or the outcome was, there was, it was certain what was going to happen in the outcome. And so I think Cleveland was trying to muck it up a little bit, and J.R. Smith is obviously a guy who has a history of doing some of that stuff. So I understood exactly what the officials were doing. I'm not sure they were exactly within the bylaws and the way they're supposed to do it, but it worked. It worked because things slowed down after that, and there weren't a bunch of physical plays.
Yeah, and even LeBron got into it, which I think was a really rare occasion to see him lose his cool and do it against the Warriors superstar in Curry when he shoved him down at half court.
Yeah, and he had a great response to that after the game because Steph did, while he's setting the screen, does grab LeBron's arm, and then LeBron kind of just throws him off like a gnat. And after the game, LeBron says, "It's like in school. Like, I wasn't the one who told the joke, but I laughed, so I was the one who got caught." And to me, it was perfect. And it was funny because when I watched the replay of it, we're pretty high up at Quicken Loans. And when I watched the replay of it, I thought it came from the back angle, so you don't see what Curry's doing. You just see him get tossed. So I didn't see that Curry had grabbed him first, but after LeBron said that, I went and watched it from a different angle, and Curry did definitely hang on to him, and LeBron was just getting rid of him.
I don't know, Mac. I don't even know if Curry could hang on to LeBron. That dude is such a beast.
That's probably true.
Did the players talk at all after the game about what this meant to them? I mean, was it a big win, or are they treating this as just another kind of victory that we're going to move on to the next game and keep playing?
Yeah, I think it was a big win for them. I think it's one that they wanted. They get up for games against the teams that have superstars, that are winning, because those are measuring stick. Those are barometer games. But because of the way the champagne, quote, blew up in the days heading into the game, they have been told to really play down everything. So their message publicly after the game was, hey, we didn't send a message to them. We only sent a message to ourselves. They talked about responding, you know, to having a bounce back game to how they played in Detroit, and said, you know, everything had to go wrong for Cleveland and everything had to go right for the Warriors for this kind of outcome. But in a couple of days when Draymond Green and Andrew Bogut aren't being told what to say, I'm sure we'll get the real responses to how they feel about that game.
Oh, I cannot wait for that, because that, you know, you're right. This was kind of the typical politically correct statements post game, but I agree with you. I know that they were feeling differently. I want to take us back to the Denver game and get your insider knowledge on the minds of Steph and Clay. If you'll remember, at the end of the game, Steph's has a chance to go against Gallinari and potentially take the lead. He dribbles around, does what I think was too fancy a move, but, you know, that's Steph Curry. You kind of live and die by that. It's plenty of time. It's worked. But he turns the ball over. Gallinari gets the steal. So he screwed up. He seemed to kind of laugh it off and move on to the next play. And then if you fast forward a couple plays, Gallinari's at the free throw line. He misses the free throw. So now the Warriors are only down by two. Clay gets the rebound and starts to dribble the ball, meaning that if they called a timeout, they couldn't advance it to half court. Luckily, Curry had called a timeout as soon as Clay got it, and the refs kind of bailed Clay out and let the Warriors take it at half court. But Clay took that mistake really hard. If you watch his reaction, he's on the bench sort of talking to himself and muttering to other people, trying to almost explain away what he was thinking. And then you saw him take the game winner or the potential of the game winner, and he missed it. So what have you seen as far as the mindset of Klay versus Steph when it comes to mistakes?
I think exactly what you described. Steph plays with a flair that I think adds to his game. It makes coaches go crazy because he plays that way. He's going to have some left-handed behind-the-back passes that go out of bounds and some lazy foot passes that get picked off. But that's part of his game. That's part of his flair. Yeah, he took 8 too many dribbles and dribbled it off his foot, and Gallinari got the ball and they lost the game. But as Curry said after the game, I'll live with that. I had a chance to win it, and I think most of the times I will. But Klay Thompson is very different. As confident as he is in his shot, his first several years in the league, he got beat up about taking bad shots, about taking them too early in the shot clock late in games and making some mental mistakes like that. And so he takes those things very seriously. He doesn't play with the same flair. He'll take a heat check shot every once in a while, but when you can shoot the way he does, you probably should do that every once in a while.
Right.
But losing a guy on a backdoor cut, you'll see him, he reacts way different than Steph Curry does when he misses a defensive assignment. And they're just different people. You see it in their games. You see it off the court. Klay Thompson takes all that stuff personally and wants to be a perfect mental player, wants to do everything right. It's never going to happen, but I think that's an okay thing to chase.
That's why he's playing chess with Andre Iguodala.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Whereas Stephen Curry goes home and plays with his two little daughters, you know, that's fun. And, you know, he'll get over it if he dribbles one off his foot. It's fine. So they're very different, and it works. It works for both of them in their own ways.
Is Klay improving at all on being able to move past mistakes and not be so hard on himself, or is it something that still really does plague him?
Yeah, the biggest stride I think I've seen in him is that as a rookie, he had a really tough job, right? Because although everybody thought he was, or most people thought he was going to be good, he had to, in the middle of a terrible season, step in and start for one of the fan favorites, Monte Ellis, who had just been traded. And at that time, it looked like the Warriors got nothing for him, right? Because Andrew Bogut was hurt and wasn't going to be out there anytime soon. Klay Thompson was starting with no real talent or leadership around him, and he had some big shoes to fill. And at that time, you would see him when he would miss shots, multiple shots. It would really affect him on the defensive end. He would take it with him to that side of the court. And I don't see that as much anymore. I don't see the shoulder slumping or that it affects other parts of his game. So to me, that's a huge stride. I'm not sure he's going to always get it all out of his system, because I do think he wants to be so good. And especially in close games, he wants to understand the game, wants to make the right decisions based on score and time, and he's been around the game and is such a hoop head, he should get those things right. And so when he doesn't, he takes it personally, and I don't think that'll ever get out of there. But the fact that he doesn't take missed shots to the other end, I think, is a huge stride.
See, I know that you say that he's such a hoop head. I mean, that makes sense. He grew up with Michael Thompson being his father, and he grew up around the game. But to me, his basketball IQ is so much lower than a guy like Steph Curry, who also grew up around the game with a dad who is a player. Is Klay's basketball IQ as low as I think, or am I not giving him credit?
Yeah, I understand that view, because Klay can look a little aloof. One of the most obvious defensive mistakes is when guys get beat backdoor, and that happens to him a lot. He's a great on-ball defender, but it makes it look like he doesn't understand the play, or it's an obviously missed assignment when a guy loses you and you're watching the ball and while your guy's going backdoor and scoring a layup. So I understand why that is. But before the Warriors are even given the scouting report at shoot-arounds for games, Klay already knows the tendencies of opposing players. He watches a ton of basketball. And I think the majority of the time now he understands score, clock, late game situations. I think all of that stuff is there, but I understand the other side of it too. And I think a lot of that is is the facial expressions that he has and some of the mistakes he makes are so obvious that I think that's probably one of the perceptions out there about him.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, for me, I also feel like he just fouls guys so often and lets them complete the three-point play, and it just drives me nuts. But I will stop my Clay hating and move us on to my final two questions in the Insider's Report.
Right, you wanted Kevin Love, right?
I wanted Kevin Love. I wanted Danny Green at one point. Like, I have come around on Clay, but I still, you can tell, I got a little bit of some questionable thoughts about him. I want to take us to a Steve Kerr update. A while back, I think it was on that Dallas road trip, there was a lot of talk like, you know, he's going to be here. He's going to coach. He's going on the road trip, and sort of this is the final step. Yet we haven't seen him on the sideline yet. What's going on here?
Nothing. He's still not healthy. And I think the Warriors were right to not put a timeline on this because, look, nobody's ever done this before. Nobody's ever come back from a spinal fluid leak and coached an NBA team. So it's not like an ankle injury where it's 4 to 6 weeks and the guy comes back. There is no timeline for this. There's been some improvement. He made a half-court shot in Cleveland.
I saw that underhanded half-court shot.
Yeah, horseshoe style. He's going to complete this trip tomorrow in Chicago, so that'll be Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago. That'll be his longest road trip of the year. The other coaches, Luke Walton, says that Kerr's energy is better for longer periods of time. So there is some progression there for sure.
Like, I mean, is he at an entire practice? Like, he's there the whole time and he's actively participating?
You know, that when they had, right before that Dallas-Houston trip, they had a 17-day span where they were at home with only 5 games. And I think he was really testing himself during that. He was really active. There was a practice that Luke Walton missed because he was sick, and Kerr ran the entire practice. But it's hard for me to get a feel for how Kerr is doing at practices because a lot of times he sits off to the side, and I'm not positive if that's because he doesn't feel well or if, as Luke Walton is the interim head coach, Kerr doesn't want to get in the way. Now, behind the scenes, in the coaching room, he has a ton of say in the game plan, in the rotations, in the minutes, how the minutes are allotted. He has a ton to do with travel plans and where they're going to practice and when they're going to practice. He's still running the team there, but from what I see in practice, he steps back. And again, I don't know if that's because his head hurts so much and his energy is so low that he can't stand during the practices, or if that's because what I think would be a very natural thing if it was to say, hey, look, Luke is the guy right now. I've got to be off to the side so that they respect him and follow what he's saying.
Is there going to come a time in this season where the players are really wanting Kerr to be there and kind of missing him in a way that they're just going to be thinking, you know, Luke, you're good and all, but like, Kerr, like we really need you at this point.
You know what? I almost think it's kind of gone the opposite way, and Luke was the guy who brought this up, that he thought the one thing that's happened while Kerr's been out is that the players have taken more ownership, that their focus has been higher, that their communication has been better because they're all trying to step up to fill Kerr's absence. So that's how it's worked so far. I'm sure there's going to be a time, whether this was the worst hiccup that they're going to have all year, if there's going to be something else. They lost 3 of 11, and there was some finger-pointing in Detroit and a long post-game meeting in the locker room. And so that was one of those situations, the first time this year where I thought, oh, man, they could use Kerr right now. Because the one thing all the players say is that he always knows the exact right thing to say at the right time. But for the most part, they just keep going along, and they find real or creative reasons to get motivated to play most games and to win most games. And they're locked in during film sessions and practices and shoot around, all trying to step up for the huge hole that's gone when Kerr's not around.
Yeah, I know that you've played basketball in the past. I don't know if you've had any of these situations where only your team only has 4 guys that you can field, like, and you go 4 versus 5, and somehow you actually play quite well and potentially are even leading the game, and the other team is just scratching their heads, like, how could these guys be even in this game with only 4 players? And I really think it's because everyone steps up and tries so much harder. And I think you may have some of that going on here with Kerr being gone, and everyone knows they've really got to step up and be focused at all times.
And I think, you know, the other thing about him is I think he's so practical about this that he probably could have come back at the start of the new year. But who knows? That was right before a really tough road portion of the schedule. In February, they have only two home games the entire month. I think he's practical in that he doesn't want to come back if there's a chance that he has to leave again. When he comes back, he wants it to be for good. And so I think that might be the only thing that's holding him up right now, is that he just doesn't want to chance that. Until he knows for sure that he's coming back for the long haul, and what they hope is a two-month playoff run, I don't think he wants to come back until he knows he can make it through all that.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. I think that makes a lot of sense, because the last thing you wanted is more question marks about him coming in and out. How about Steve Nash? I haven't heard a single thing about him all season. Is he still kind of around this Warriors organization?
No, he hasn't been around much, and it was interesting. It was an interesting hire. Any time you can get smart basketball minds, the Warriors are going to hire him. They've shown that with Jerry West and Rick Welts and Bob Myers and Steve Kerr and this entire assistant coaching staff. If there's a guy out there, it doesn't matter how much it costs, they're going to get him. And so I think the Steve Nash hire made a lot of sense. But as soon as they hired him, Kerr talked about, hey, look, he just retired. He needs to get a chance to get away. You know, he was such a workout fanatic. He needs to get a chance to be away from that, to actually relax for a little bit. And so I got the impression early on that he wasn't going to be around a ton. But when the team is in L.A., Nash usually makes an appearance. He's been up to Oakland a couple of times. And even an hour with Klay Thompson teaching a master's class in pick and rolls is very helpful. And I think down on the road we'll see him more. I just think right now he needs that time away from the game. He needs to be retired for a little bit before he goes straight into this. But he did. He is doing some other stuff. He's a part owner of a soccer team now, and he's going to help Drake, assistant coach, the celebrity game at the All-Star game in Toronto. So he's got some other stuff going on, but I think he's also enjoying retirement a little bit.
But another great smart move by the management here. I mean, just let's pick up this guy after he just retired. We'll just kind of put him on retainer just so we can use him when we need him. He sort of forms a affiliation and gets to know the organization a bit, and then when we're ready and really need him and want to call on him, he'll be there for us. I think it's a smart move. Let's move on to the Warriors' focus. And you mentioned the Detroit game and sort of how frustrating the team seemed to play there. I agree with you. I've never seen them lose their cool like they did in the Detroit game. They seemed to be yelling at the refs, yelling at each other. What was the sense there as to why this team got kind of lost their cool for the first time?
Yeah, it was wild. Since I've been covering the league, I've never seen an atmosphere like that at Auburn Hills. Detroit's been really bad since I've been covering the league. But Draymond's homecoming, plus the retirement of Ben Wallace's jersey, Auburn Hills was apparently the way it used to be during the Wallace and Phillips and Rip Hamilton Sheed days. It was a great atmosphere for a basketball game. And when I saw that, I thought the Warriors would run the Pistons out of the building, because they love that us against the world thing, the just us. They love trying to silence the crowd. And so my impression was that the Warriors would love that situation. Instead, Detroit was the more physical team. Some calls didn't go their way. They missed some shots. Shoulders started slumping. They pointed fingers for the first time. Like I said, the post-game locker room was closed for a long time before they allowed the media in. It was just an interesting thing, and I think a lot of it was that game itself, because there was not much energy from the Warriors. They missed a ton of defensive assignments. They played hero ball on offense. They weren't passing it. They were settling for 35-foot jumpers, trying to make up 20-point leads on one shot. So I think a lot of it did have to do with that game itself, but they also had lost 11 or 3 out of 11 games and hadn't played very well in the other 8. So I think it was kind of a, hey, let's get this thing back together type of deal. And as Andre Iguodala said after the Cleveland game, they probably needed one of those games. They needed to get slapped in the face once to kind of get their attention.
Exactly. And they have done exactly what you need to do with a loss like that, where they've completely flipped it into absolute positive by now renewing their commitment to the things that made them great. They were back to having back cuts against Cleveland. They were back to moving the ball. They were back to just having a joy about them in a way that has kind of been missing.
Yeah, and if only it was that easy, right? That you lose, you get embarrassed, and then you go and beat the best team in the Eastern Conference where you're up by 43 points and never trail. Others have a little harder time bouncing back that way. But that shows you how talented the Warriors are and how competitive they are, that they can just flip it back on like that.
Another game that kind of went by since the last time we did the podcast is the Lakers game, and this was Kobe's last appearance at Oracle. The crowd was really fired up for Kobe in a way that I found a little surprising. I mean, this was a guy who was your nemesis. He was your enemy. He was the main guy that you hated for all these years. And here you are giving him standing ovations, chanting his name. Were you a little surprised by how much love the crowd gave him?
I was. I talked to Reggie Miller before the game because Miller had just done Kobe's last stop in Sacramento. And obviously anybody in the league knows about getting booed in one certain building. It's Reggie Miller going back to the Mecca, going back to Madison Square Garden. So I thought he'd be a really good source for it. And he had the same prediction that I did. I thought Oracle, Oakland fans are so good that they'll respect the greatness of Kobe Bryant, his legacy. They'll cheer him during the introductions, and then they'll boo him the entire game. Every time he touches the ball, they'll boo him. If he makes a shot, they'll boo him. That's what I expected. And that kind of started. He scored 6 points really early, and there were lots of boos. But then the Warriors had the game in hand, and Kobe missed a ton of his next dozen shots. And so then at that point, I think they almost felt sorry for him and wanted to cheer for him one more time. And when the game was out of hand in the fourth quarter, they chanted for him. And I thought that was pretty cool that Byron Scott put him back in there, respected the Oakland fans that much to put Kobe back in there one last time. I would be really interested to see if Kobe had had a good game, if the Lakers were a threat at all to the Warriors, if the game had been close, I wonder if the Oracle fans wouldn't have been like normal, if they wouldn't have booed his every touch. But we'll never know, because the game was so out of hand, because Kobe wasn't playing well. I think it was all love and respecting what he had done in his last 19 years instead of what they were seeing right then.
See, I don't know if they would, because I wonder if this was almost one of those games like used to happen to the Warriors, where the majority of the crowd was actually Lakers fans, because the Lakers fans bought up all the tickets. And to me,
right,
I bet you a lot of true Laker fans who live in the Bay Area were like, I will pay out the ass for tickets to this game. So that's potentially why you had them cheering so loudly.
Yeah, there certainly was a large contingent of Laker fans there. Nothing like the bad Warriors teams where it was more than 50% Lakers. But there were quite a few who obviously had paid top dollar to get in there. But even the people who were wearing Warriors garb were part of the people chanting for Kobe late. And I think that speaks to, look, the Bay Area fans are Warrior fans, but they're also fans of hoop. And I think regardless of what you think about Kobe Bryant, you got to respect the guy who's played 20 years for one franchise and played this well for this long. And I think that's what they were doing. They were just showing him respect.
No, yeah, for sure. One thing that has been cropping up, and I think, you know, hopefully we saw the end of it in the Cleveland game, but it culminated again in the Detroit game, was this second unit. And this backup squad has sort of been dropping the ball. When in Detroit, for instance, fourth quarter, Warriors were only down by 11. They put the backups in, and all of a sudden, I think Detroit went on a 9-0 run. It was a 20-point game, and the game was over. What is going on with the players off the bench?
Well, I don't know how they're going to score. And I thought that was pretty obvious early on in the year, even during the 24-0 start.
What about Barbosa?
I mean, if he's your primary scorer off the bench, I think you're in trouble. You look at that group. Sean Livingston has a couple spots. He can hit a turnaround jumper on the baseline against some guys. He can get to that 15-foot pull-up jumper, and he can score. But if he's your primary scorer, you're in trouble. Barbosa can slash. He can back cut. He knows the counters to the counters. But if he's your primary scorer, if he's taking jump shots, you're in trouble. Andre Iguodala does not want to shoot. If he's your primary scorer, you're in trouble. Harrison Barnes is having to play backup power forward because Mo Spates is not playing well. James Michael McAdoo's hurt. Jason Thompson doesn't know the offense. And so what you're seeing right now is that they're dumping the ball down to Festus Ezeli. And if that's your primary scorer, I think Festus is going to be great. But if that's your primary scorer, you're in trouble. So right now they can't score. When they don't get stops and don't get out in transition, they just have no way to score. And all of a sudden, you go from down 11 to down 18, and you got to rush Stephen Curry and Draymond and Klay Thompson back out there. We saw this early in the year. Remember the game at Indiana? They're running away with all these games, but it's because the starters are making up for the backups. The backups almost blew that game. They had to put Klay Thompson back in there, and he lands on somebody's foot and hurts his ankle. I think there have been signs of this all year, and I think they need to do something to that group.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the question is, you know, what can they do at this point? Are we stuck with this? Is this what we're just going to have to live and die by and hope the starters either play more minutes or just create a big enough lead that it's not a problem?
Yeah, I think the couple of things. One, they started exploring getting Klay Thompson out earlier in the first and third quarter so that he can come back quicker or even start, I think, at some point. Second and fourth quarters, so that the idea is to always have one of the three, at least, of between Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green on the floor. And they got away with that. They were doing the full hockey substitution where they had five reserves out there. So I think that's one thing they can do in the immediate time frame. The other option, which they've played with, is playing Harrison Barnes at the backup power forward a lot. But they don't want to run guys out there for 40 minutes a night. And now that he's back in the starting lineup as a small forward, I don't think they can keep running him out there for equal amount of time as a backup power forward. And so to me, that says a month before the trade deadline, you better be looking for a backup power forward and preferably one who can score.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, right, where all that was going was right down to the potential to have a trade. Is there something on the table, anything brewing?
Not yet. I think the Warriors have proven that if there's talk, they want to be part of it. And they are always looking for ways to get better. I think they're in a little bit of a quagmire here because do you mess with the greatest team in the history of basketball, to get a backup power forward? Or do you recognize what's happening, that even though you're winning these games, there's a clear problem there, and you risk it. You break up some of the continuity, some of the chemistry to go get somebody. There are some people who I think can help. I think Ryan Anderson is an obvious one. He's on the block. He's a power forward who can stretch the floor and score. Terrence Jones' name's out there. The one I'm really intrigued by, and you might hate this, is the Warriors have worked so hard on this locker room. It's a pristine place. The chemistry is amazing. And they always say, because it's so good now, we can handle a jerk. And I don't know that they've really tried it yet. Maybe Jordan Crawford is the closest thing that they've tried. But Markieff Morris is out there, and I don't think it's going to take much to get him. That would be something that I would explore. I would, obviously, as Bob Myers is fantastic at doing, I would get information from everybody before I made that move and make sure the players and the coaching staff was all on board with it and know that if it didn't work, you can cut them immediately and just tell them to go away. But that is one that really intrigues me because the Warriors don't have a ton of assets. They don't have a ton of draft picks. I don't think they have a bunch of developmental players in the eyes of other teams. So to go get somebody, I think, is going to be hard. But if there's somebody out there like Markieff Morris who Phoenix wants to get rid of, I think that's somebody you can go get.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm a huge chemistry guy, so that does scare me a lot. But the thing is, we'll know within the month because the trade deadline's coming up. And like you said, there'd still be a lot of time to work them in and still get kind of a sense of, is this guy going to be somebody that is going to fit or not? And like you said, you could cut him, but gosh, it just, I don't know. It's dicey.
Just thinking about the Jordan Crawford deal, they went through 100 point guards that year, knew they needed a backup point guard after they let Jared Jack go. They tried to give it to Kent Bazemore, tried to give it to Nemanja Nedovic, tried to make Iguodala the backup point guard. I mean, they tried everything. and then they made a move to go get Jordan Crawford. But even in a deadline-driven business, Bob Myers made the great move of doing it well before the deadline, where if it didn't work, he could go make another move. And then he went and got Steve Blake when it didn't work. If I'm the Warriors, that's what I'm considering if I'm doing the marquee thing. I'm doing it right now so that I still have time to react if it doesn't work.
Yeah, that would be the smart way to do it. Let's move on to story time with Uncle Rusty. I'm gonna put out one that obviously I think we'd all love to hear some stories about, Steph Curry. What you got anything on Steph?
Yeah, I've got a lot on him. A bunch of them. I guess, you know what? Probably one of my favorite ones is Ron Krawczyk, who's our great golf writer. We talked about Stephen Curry all summer, and I told him these stories about when the team was in China for the exhibition season, that Steph and I were doing this diary while he was over there. And so I'm waking up at ungodly hours to answer these phone calls from Curry. And, you know, he was already a star at that point. But if he couldn't do it at the exact time that he said, he would still call at that time and apologize and say, look, I'll call you in 30 minutes. And he always did. And so I was really impressed by that. And I was telling Ron Krawczyk about that. And then he one-upped me. He goes, oh, yeah, well, while Steph was on vacation one time, he called me from an unblocked number while he's on vacation, just sat and chatted about golf for a while.
Wow.
And I think those kind of things speak to Stephen Curry. And I always joke with him about when he's going to turn into a superstar and stop all that stuff. But it seems like every writer has a story like that with Curry, that he's never going to be that superstar type. He's always going to have a little Tim Duncan in him.
Well, I hope Bram listens to this so that he can give me more than 30 minutes of a heads up that he's not going to be on the show.
Yeah, right.
Hey, Rusty, huge fun as always. We'd love to hear from any listeners, so email us at warriorshuddle@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter at warriorshuddle. We're on all types of different podcasting services, including iTunes. More than that, get out there, tell your friends to listen to the show. Word of mouth, it really means a lot. And you already know where to find Rusty, or at least he thinks you already know.
If they don't know by now, they're never going to know.
Well, I could tell them, but I won't. Go Warriors, and hopefully we'll see you next week. Good, good.